Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama heads to New Hampshire to speak at a town hall meeting on health care. His ambitious overhaul agenda has been met with loud protests and a great deal of confusion. Joining me to talk about fact and fiction in the increasingly heated healthcare debate, Susan Dentzer. She's editor-in-chief of Health Affairs and on-air analyst on health issues for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. C.C. Connolly is a reporter for The Washington Post, and Noam Levy is a reporter for The Los Angeles Times. Do join us. Questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. I know that many of you have so many questions and much confusion. We'll try to sort it out today. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Cece, give us a recap of where we are with this legislation now.
Right now, Congress is in recess until after Labor Day. Before leaving, we had three committees in the House of Representatives approve versions of a bill crafted by their chairman. Each are fairly similar. They require individuals to carry health insurance, which would be a new requirement in this country called an individual mandate. They look to most employers to also contribute to the cost. And there are provisions to increase taxes on the wealthy to help cover many of the uninsured in this country. Those are sort of the high points of the House approach. Over in the Senate, the Health Committee, normally run by Senator Edward Kennedy, but Senator Dodd filling in for him, passed a similar bill. But really, the action that we're waiting for over in the Senate is the Senate Finance Committee, which, of course, for many, many months now has been holding a series of negotiations and talks, trying to come up with more of a bipartisan compromise approach. They haven't done that. Their new deadline is September 15th, and we'll see what they can come up with by then.
So now, Susan Dentzer, is everyone's opportunity to speak out and to comment on health care. What's happening?
Well, Diane, as we've seen just in the last couple of weeks, just an enormous eruption. Some people say it's grassroots. Other people call it astroturf, that is to say fake grassroots, of people who have concerns, some legitimate, some not, frankly, legitimate, not actually reflected in the legislation, about the direction it's going in. There are concerns about rationing, that is to say that something will be enacted in health reform that will withhold care from people. There are particular concerns about rationing at the end of life. We're hearing phrases like kill granny provision, et cetera, et cetera. All kinds of noise, as I say, some probably born out of ignorance, some possibly partisan motivated, that is suggesting that things that are not in the bill actually are in the bill and could lead to deleterious results for many individuals.
And Noam, yesterday you wrote a piece in the LA Times sorting out some of the claims being made about health care legislation. Let's talk about the one that Susan just mentioned. Does this legislation include provisions to encourage senior citizens to commit suicide?
Quite simply, no. There is a provision in the House version of the bill that would provide a benefit to senior citizens to sit down with a doctor and talk about options for how they would like to be cared for at the end of life. The way it's structured is a Medicare payment for the physician to actually do this consultation. These might include things like talking about living wills, how to be cared for when you become incapacitated. It's voluntary. There's no suggestion in any of the language that it would encourage a choice one way or the other. But as Susan mentioned, it has become incredibly inflammatory and has been used, I think, quite cynically by some to suggest that somehow the federal government would be encouraging an end-of-life choice.
Now, my husband and I have already done this. We've talked to our lawyer. We've talked to our doctor. I would presume that many people have already done this. Why has this particular area of the healthcare proposal met such inflammatory discounting?
Well, I think there's a political reason for it, actually, more than a medical one. I think you're right. Most people have made that decision, I think, like you and your husband have. There are a lot of seniors, though, who probably haven't for one reason or another, and doctors are often running from one appointment to another. Perhaps they don't have time to talk to their patients about these sorts of things. There's a broad range of opinion among professionals that this is something that should happen. But remember, senior citizens are a pretty important political force in this country.
You know, Diane, only about 30% of Americans have living wills. It's a surprisingly low number. And I think there are a variety of reasons for that. It's a difficult conversation for people to have. It should probably often start as a family conversation.
Absolutely.
But again, imagine being the adult child saying to an older parent, okay, we need to sit down and figure out about, you know, your final weeks and months. I mean, it's such a very awkward, difficult subject for people to discuss. You mentioned going to your lawyer, which I think is what most people now do because they see it as a legal action that they take. But again, the idea behind this provision of paying a physician to do a counseling session is that maybe it's a conversation you'd also like to have with a medical professional, not just a lawyer.
The statistics show, Diane, that almost 90% of Americans, when surveyed, say they would prefer to die at home. But actually 80% of Americans on Medicare who die every year die in institutions, either nursing homes or hospitals. Many in ICUs, hooked up to tubes, when they actually would prefer not to do that. And Assisi says part of the issue is that so few people sign not just living wills, but it's the whole raft of advanced directives, including durable power of attorneys, which basically assigns somebody else the ability to make decisions on your behalf if you're incapacitated, which some people think is the most important thing that people should sign. But in any case, what we have is this incredible disconnect between what people want, what they do, and the fact that there's really no lever in the system that gets people to do this, even though, for example, we've had on the books since 1991 the Patient Self-Determination Act, which means when you go into a hospital, the hospital has to tell you that you have the right to sign advance directives. And even despite that, we have this relatively low number of people, comparatively speaking, who are making these active decisions.
Now, we've had an email saying, why don't spokespersons for the plan explain that traditionally Medicare and insurers do not pay for these consultations and that these procedures are usually billable? The provision that we're talking about would simply allow the physician to be reimbursed for the time spent discussing end-of-life decisions with a Medicare patient who wants this discussion. Somehow, the limitation of today's reimbursement system are not being mentioned.
Well, as we know, in healthcare, as in many things, we get what we pay for. And the fee-for-service payment system under Medicare essentially pays physicians and other providers mostly on a piecework basis. If something is authorized by Medicare, the doctor can do it and can get paid for that. So unless something is actually stipulated as being something that could be paid for, it doesn't tend to happen because physicians, frankly, are stressed. We know that there's a shortage of primary care doctors who would be the kinds of doctors who would have these conversations with people. If you're trying to rotate people through your office in a 12-minute visit, you don't have time to sit down and talk about these issues.
So what you've had is Congresswoman Virginia Fox, Republican of North Carolina, said to seniors that they would be put to death by their government.
I mean, some of the hyperbole is truly shocking. You know, we've heard Governor Palin, former Governor Palin, talk about these death panels She's actually expanded it in her Facebook commentary beyond senior citizens to Down syndrome, children, you know, playing off of, I think, a very potent emotional fear that Americans may have that the government may be making determinations about their care. That's a playbook that's been used in the past, and I suspect Congresswoman Fox and Sarah Palin and others are eager to go back to it.
Cece, what about the politics of this approach? What about the hyperbole, the statements that go beyond the pale? How is that affecting the thinking and the politics of this whole thing?
Well, I think that initially the Obama White House and the Democrats in Congress were caught off guard by some of the potency of the attacks and the criticism and those early days of recess when we saw so many of the town hall meetings disrupted initially. We'd already seen support in a number of polls starting to drop down a little bit. That wasn't terribly surprising. It always happens once you get into the complex details of legislation affecting so many people and so many industries. But very clearly, the Obama administration has been on defense, and that is not where you want to be in a difficult legislative battle like this. Now, I think at this point, there's a danger that the critics may overreach with some of this. As you say, some of the rhetoric now going beyond the pale, and that could provide a backlash.
Cece Connolly of the Washington Post, Norm Levy, Los Angeles Times, Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs. Short break. When we come back, we'll talk about rationing. If you'd like to join the conversation, which I hope you will, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We have Susan Dentzer, Cece Connolly, Noam Levy, all of whom have been reporting on the healthcare debate. Susan Dentzer, this morning I heard former Secretary of State, former high-level advisor to the former President Bush, talking about the mistakes he thought President Obama had made on this health care program.
Yes, and Secretary Baker's observation is that the president, in this case President Obama, should have taken a major leadership position, prepared a piece of legislation, introduced it, said, here is our plan, et cetera. And of course, the administration has taken the exactly opposite approach. Technically speaking, there is no Obama health reform plan. There's a set of principles. And as Cece said earlier, the bills are being crafted in Congress. I think what this is, has been a reaction to is that during the Clinton years, obviously, the first course of action was taken. The administration prepared a more than 1,600-page bill of incredible detail. It sent it up to Congress and said, here's our plan, and it fell completely flat. So since we're all generals fighting the last war, the Obama folks said, well, we're not going to make that terrible mistake. We'll let Congress work through the details. That was the advice they were getting consistently from even Secretary of State Clinton, who, of course, lived through the prior experience, said, don't don't, you know, let Congress work it through. So I think what this tells us, frankly, is there's no good way to do health care reform. Mm. No matter what you do, you're going to encounter lots of obstacles, and we're seeing that play out now.
Cece, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And I would generally agree with Susan. I think that it's a delicate balance for the administration to strike on something like this. I agree that if he had dropped a detailed legislative proposal on Capitol Hill, they would have had their noses out of joint, so to speak, because they feel that it's their prerogative. On the other hand, he's probably coming to the dance a little bit late. If he had been a little bit more engaged, even probably a month ago, and also, what they could have done was left his advisors in Washington working behind the scenes, quietly doing the deals that we've seen with industry and with Congress, but had him out in the country doing what he does well, which is communicating to the public about, here's what I'm up to, here are my goals, here are my principles.
No.
And I think you've seen a little bit of that with President Obama going to this town hall in New Hampshire. He's been doing these the past few weeks around the country. But one thing I think that there's an additional frustration on the Hill that there hasn't been more coordination among Democrats on the Hill and the White House about how they're talking about health care reform, and that's something that they are, I think, a little bit late to the dance
about.
It's
interesting that you say that, because the opposition sounds all the same.
That's right.
And what you're saying is that the support is very fragmented.
I think it's a little bit fragmented. It's always easier, of course, to be against something this complicated. All you have to do is stand up and say, this is really complicated, we shouldn't do this. But I think there was a general feeling at first that if the president and his allies on the Hill talked generally about how this is the time, we need to do it, that would in some way rally the country. And I think they've recognized a little bit more now that they need to sort of provide more very specific examples of what's in it for people. Why should we do this?
And you know what's so fascinating, though, Diane, even we've been talking about some of these end-of-life provisions. AARP has not yet endorsed a bill. The pharmaceutical industry right now is running advertisements in favor of healthcare reform, but has not yet endorsed a piece of legislation. So you have this awkward circumstance where a number of groups with money and clout are saying, sure, we want some kind of reform, but we're really not satisfied with what you've come up with yet. So, you know, it's tough.
Let's talk about another fact versus fiction rationing, Noam.
Well, this is a complicated one, I think, in part because there, at the basic level, there's nothing in the bill that would ration care for basic benefits for Medicare beneficiaries. However, a discussion of rationing sort of depends on how you define what rationing is currently in the system and what kinds of choices are being made by both the federal government and private insurers. So to take one, for example, currently private insurers routinely deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. You could argue that's a form of rationing. That will be specifically prohibited in the new legislation. So does that mean less rationing? Sure. On the other hand, there's also a development in an idea in development in the legislation that we should have a better idea of what is actually works and what doesn't work. And when you start having that kind of a discussion, is it possible that somewhere down the line someone will make a decision that because we know that, you know, pill B doesn't work as well as pill A, that we shouldn't be paying for pill B? I think most people honestly would say we should have that conversation. Just one final thing. I think also most people in the healthcare world would acknowledge that discussion is going to happen no matter what. It's already happening now, and it's going to continue happening whether healthcare legislation passes or not.
What about this whole idea of a woman with a brain tumor in Canada who had to wait 8 months to see a doctor? That's been running for a long time as an example of what could happen if this kind of legislation is passed here.
Yes, and I think that a lot of this gets tied up with other aspects of the legislation, such as the proposal in the House bill to have a public plan, a public health insurance plan, essentially a Medicare-like plan that's available to all, which has been decried by many on the right as socialized medicine, because this would be a socialized system like, for example, Medicare is, where the government, essentially we as taxpayers, finance the plan.
Don't you love that quote from somebody out there? You keep the government out of my Medicare plan.
A famous story from 93 and 94 when an old lady came up to Senator John Brough of Louisiana in an airport and said precisely that to him. And we're hearing the same kinds of things today. I think, just to go back to rationing for a moment, we also have to talk about the uninsured. We have probably 50 million people uninsured in this country today. They get rationed against every day. We know that the uninsured as a group only get about two-thirds as much health care as those who are insured. We know that every day in America's emergency rooms, even though there's a law in the books that says when people come in, they have to be stabilized before they can be discharged, we know how quickly people are transferred out to other hospitals as fast as they can possibly be. So we know rationing is systematically going on. A real issue is are things going to get better if, in fact, we cover the uninsured?
Cece, what about the question as to whether immigrants here illegally would get free health care benefits?
The easiest way to answer that question, Diane, is that current law would stay in place. So the only treatment that illegal immigrants or anyone without insurance who shows up at the hospital, as Susan was mentioning, we have a law that says those individuals must be stabilized at a hospital. Now, stabilized is a term that can certainly be interpreted any number of ways. It can be a pretty quick kind of Band-Aid fix, and they're out the door again. It's not necessarily chemotherapy for 3 months. So, but the short answer is that no, illegal immigrants would not be covered by any of the proposals that Congress is now considering.
How would the Medicare system change? Many people are afraid that there would be money taken from Medicare to fund everything else that President Obama wants to do. I have heard the president say it is only the growth in Medicare that would be slowed. What's the truth?
No. Well, I mean, Medicare is huge. And
enormous.
At one level, Medicare has been a fantastic success. It's covered, it's provided medical care for people in their old age. It's something that was a horrible, heartbreaking condition before 1965. On the other hand, Medicare has failed to do a lot of things particularly well, like controlling the growth of costs, providing incentives for different ways that medicine would be delivered. So the president's has talked a lot about changing some of the incentives. The legislation includes programs to try to change the way that doctors and hospitals work together to provide care to senior citizens. Some of those things may change a little bit going forward, depending on whether or not they're successful. There's a one example, for instance, is an idea that the federal government should incentivize primary care physicians to coordinate the care better that they're providing to senior citizens, so that senior citizens aren't sent from their primary care doctor to one hospital or another, an imaging center. Nobody knows exactly where they're going. That might change. That might very well be an improvement.
It's also the case that there's a program called Medicare Advantage that would be scaled back. And this is a program that, in essence, gives senior citizens and others eligible for Medicare the right to enroll in HMOs or preferred provider organizations or other kind of comprehensive health care plans, which frequently have additional benefits attached to them, free eyeglasses, other consultations with physicians, health club memberships in some cases. It's widely agreed that these plans are overpaid. Everybody agrees that that was done. It was done, in fact, to spur extension of these programs. But some people think that the plans should not be overpaid, and in fact, that the 14% payment advantage they have over the rest of Medicare should be taken away and put back into other aspects of the program or other aspects of health care reform. So it is the case that there will be cuts in Medicare Advantage that probably will result in fewer benefits being available to some of the people in them now. But again, this is all about trade-offs, and the sense is that these plans have been overpaid relative to what they're really delivering to individuals. And we'll see how this plays out.
Cece.
The numbers are that Medicare is projected to cost nearly $7 trillion, that's T as in Tom, over the next decade, and that most of the legislative proposals right now would trim about $500 billion out of that $7 trillion over the next 10 years. Most of those changes, Susan mentioned the Medicare Advantage trims, which is the biggest chunk of money. There'd also be a little bit less money for hospitals because there is a feeling that hospitals need some pressure to start dealing with things like hospital-acquired infections and other complications that you bring you back into the hospital. Medicare, almost 20% of Medicare beneficiaries who go to the hospital return within 30 days, return unnecessarily. They're called preventable readmissions, and it's a high rate. So some of the squeezing down on hospital payments, again, are an attempt to get them to handle care a little bit differently.
Cece, you've written about healthcare a great deal in the last few weeks and months. What kinds of responses are you getting?
Well, you know, I covered politics for a long, long time, and often my phone and my mailbox would be kind of empty. And covering healthcare, that's never the case. People are very engaged and interested in it, and most of the time, that's extremely rewarding to know that people are so interested in the stories. I will say that over the past week or so, with some of the misinformation around the death panels, as Governor Palin put it, or kill granny, that some of it has been pretty hostile and very negative.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think it's time to open the phones. Let's talk with our listeners and see what their thoughts are and the kind of information they feel they need to make good decisions about these proposals. Let's go first to Tim in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Just a comment. I could see this whole thing coming from 1,000 miles away, and this is just the failure of the president, I think, of just to educate the American public in a general sense as what the objectives are, what the problems are, and where we need to go. I mean, you don't have to you know, be too bright to figure out that this is just a ditto of what the Clintons tried to do a while back and how they got their brains beat in by all this treating of the facts like trash and appealing to people's appealing to the Americans' general breadth and depth of ignorance of just about all of this stuff. That's basically what I wanted to say.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Well, there are certainly lots of people suggesting that the president take a couple of years, go around the country, talk about this, hold lots of town meetings, and get national consensus. But that was competing against a prerogative that said, if you don't get this done in your first year, it will never happen. And that was another lesson that some people took away from the Clinton experience, which is that it didn't happen in the first year. The president lost a lot of political capital, and therefore it never happened for 15 more years. So, again, I think it underscores the complexity of this entire business and why there may not be a single good way to do this.
No.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. The other thing that I think sort of is encouraging the swifter action by the president is the enormous amount of work that was done before this year by a lot of the interest groups in the healthcare arena, insurers, hospitals, doctors, some of the business groups, consumer groups, et cetera, who many of whom saw an opportunity now to change the system, obviously in ways that would benefit each of their interests. But I think there was a sense by the president as well as his congressional allies that that was a situation that might not repeat itself and that that momentum should be seized.
All right. To Manchester, New Hampshire. Good morning, Jerry.
Hi. Would it be possible to have published and made readily available to the public a list of how much money senators and individual representatives have accepted from the drug and insurance lobbies?
Cece.
Well, Jerry, you're in luck. There is a very impressive organization known as the Center for Responsive Politics that has a website. I believe it's opensecrets.org. And you can go there and look up very current information in terms of campaign contributions from individuals as well as PACs. You can sort it on that website by different industries, companies, you name it.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Good response. Thanks for calling, Jerry. To what extent do we know if the people who are out there protesting the kinds of ideas that could change the health care plan are truly understanding what it's about, or are they out there protesting politically? No.
Well, I don't know. I think that's tough to answer. I mean, certainly there are a lot of people, I think, who have misconceptions about the legislation. On the other hand, I think you could argue that some of their concerns about a piece of legislation that is this large and this complicated are legitimate. I know there are people there are lawmakers on Capitol Hill who are trying to make their way through this legislation and are very nervous about it.
See, Noam Levy, he's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Cece Conley with the Washington Post, Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Island Press and the Tides Foundation. Island Press provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Writing and publishing a book is a team effort. An award-winning novelist and her distinguished editor discuss their three decades of collaboration. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We're going to go right back to the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning. I feel very sad and angry about a lot of the conservative rights that have taken such an extreme view of what the president is in fact trying to bring about, which is very necessary, a discussion with the physician as well as parents that are aging to make clear with their children what they want and what they don't want. I've seen numerous accounts over the 30 years of nursing where children have to try and make decisions for their parents when they've been in a very compromised position, and that discussion has never taken place. I think it's a very good thing, and I'm very sad, as I said, that a lot of the conservative rights have blown this totally out of proportion, and in fact, it doesn't even mean anything of what he really said.
Cece.
Well, and it's interesting talking about the family not having that discussion, but I also learned in reporting on this subject some that often family physicians don't know a patient's wishes. And even sometimes a patient who has had some medical directives and written some things down, and that patient suddenly is in the hospital, and even the physician does not really know their preferences. So it's a conversation that's worth having with probably several people in your life.
Well, I was just going to say a noted expert in palliative care named Dr. Ira Byock of Dartmouth-Hitchcock tells the story, the same story again and again and again, of dealing with patients in the final stages of illness who are hooked up to tubes, talking to their loved ones, and have the loved ones consistently say, I never thought it would come to this. Mm. We all do. I mean, we have 100% likelihood of dying, each of us, and we never talk about death. And so just to begin to introduce this conversation, I think most people would agree would be very helpful.
I think it really could begin a conversation among many family members, and that's all to the good. To Frank in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay, I have a son that had leukemia for 20 years ago. He was treated for 5, and he goes every year for they could look him over and stuff like that. Okay, now I pay $1,655. Okay, before, when he had insurance, the insurance company used to send me a bill saying that they were paying $1,465, but they were actually only paying $660. I was paying $330, and nobody was paying the $475 that were less. So I was thinking that maybe the insurance, that the amount of money that we see, that, you know, that we're all paying, isn't really even the amount. We're actually paying 22.5% of what that is and whatever it is for people. And anyone could go to YouTube, go to Fight Back Against Health Insurance Lies, and you could see something about what I was talking about.
Cece.
Well, Frank gets at one of the, I think, frustrations that so many of us have with the health system in this country. There's never one set price on any procedure in this country, and it's not like when you go to the grocery store or you go to buy an article of clothing and there's a price tag on things. And what generally happens in our health system today is if you have insurance, those insurance companies are negotiating prices with doctors and hospitals and dialysis centers and you name it. And if they're a big, effective negotiator, they can probably get a little bit of a discount on some things. It is ironic, Diane, that in this country, the people without insurance tend to pay the highest prices for everything in this system because they have no bargaining power.
And the legislation very clearly is designed to try to get at some of this by providing some additional choice for people. One of the interesting things I think about the way Medicare works right now is that it is actually a fairly transparent process, that one can actually see the reasoning that the federal government uses for why it chooses to pay one thing or another. People disagree about what the result is, but it is a fairly transparent process. With private insurers, it's very difficult for people to find out why an insurer is paying one thing or another.
All right, and let's talk about how President Obama hopes to pay for this whole program. Susan.
Well, the total cost of the legislation that has been written up to date is about $1 trillion. And to put that into context, this nation will spend $33 trillion on health care over the next 10 years. So we're talking about adding to that $3 trillion another $1 trillion over 10 years, essentially to cover the cost of the uninsured. The legislation that would be paid for in a variety of ways, as Cece said earlier, on the House side, there's an increase in the taxes paid by very high-income taxpayers that would pick up a good amount of that. There were these various savings that we discussed earlier in Medicare and so forth and so on. We don't know on the Senate side what the main revenue-raising proposals are going to be coming out of the Finance Committee, which is the Tax Writing Committee of the Senate. So those will be very critical to see. But I think on balance, the president has said the plan must pay for itself. Mm. It cannot be added to the deficit. And that is certainly the goal of the Senate Finance Committee, is to have this fully paid for.
Cece, what about taxing these high-end insurance companies, high-end insurers who provide these very special, expensive financial programs?
Well, initially, Senator Max Baucus, the chairman of that finance committee, was hoping to impose a tax above a certain threshold. So if you had a health policy that was more than, say, $15,000, you'd have to pay a tax above that amount. It would sort of count as additional income, a benefit that you're getting through your employer. What's happened is that that notion has lost some steam in recent weeks. And now Senator Baucus is said to be looking at a similar approach, but the insurance company would actually be paying that tax. It would work along the lines of a sales tax. It would probably be on policies over $30,000, so very generous health plans, but it would still raise quite a bit of revenue.
What about small business? How would small business owners be affected? No.
Well, it depends on the size of a small business. I mean, one of the complexities of designing policy for small business is defining what a small business is. In general terms, the idea is that many small businesses would have access to this new regulated insurance marketplace where they could, their employees could choose amongst a menu of private plans as well as a new government insurance plan. Some of them would also be eligible for some assistance from the federal government to help defray the costs of the insurance premiums for their employees. Now, on the other side, those that do not, those that are over a certain number of employees, 50 is where it has been set in one piece of legislation, there are penalties for those that don't provide insurance. So the big debate is sort of where is the cutoff for a small business that gets benefits and those that don't.
Where is the government option right now, Cece?
My sense is that it's fading fast. We saw negotiations in the House Energy and Commerce Committee to essentially weaken the proposal for a government-run option so that it is now, instead of setting its prices along the lines of Medicare, they'd be negotiated by the secretary. Over in the Senate, we are increasingly hearing that it would be very hard to get the votes for any sort of government-run option. So the most recent conversations there, again, we're told they don't have a plan out yet, but are centering more around a concept that Senator Conrad has been promoting, known as cooperatives, similar to the utility cooperatives.
How would that work? That's what nobody can explain to me, Susan.
Well, one model is an entity known as Group Health out in Washington State, which is technically a consumer cooperative. It's basically a health insurance plan. It's a health plan. It's like an HMO. Essentially, it's supposed to be owned by the policyholders. It's not unlike, say, mutual insurance used to be, which was owned by the policyholders, and the policyholders were represented by a board that helped to govern the company.
But
it would be this kind of a concept, possibly.
Can people choose their own physicians within that cooperative?
Yes, but you deal with a panel of physicians in that cooperative. But many people are enrolled in group health and actually like it quite a bit. And it's importantly, as Cece said, it's not a government option. It's private. It's nonprofit. Not, again, dissimilar from, say, Kaiser Permanente, which is another huge HMO that operates in many parts of the country. So the one notion is that there would be lots of these cooperatives cropping up and given some money to start up in various states. There might be a national health insurance cooperative that could be formed, et cetera. This is really a work in progress.
No.
Well, there is actually the group health cooperative is interesting because it is a whole integrated health system. So the insurer, in this case the cooperative, actually owns the means of delivery for the doctors, the hospitals in the system. There are a couple of other ones around the country. I know in Southern California, there's an agricultural cooperative. Farmers have banded together to buy, to create a cooperative that then provides insurance to the farmers' employees and negotiates rates with doctors and hospitals, mainly in the Central Valley of California. And I think that probably is closer to what is realistic in terms of creating a new cooperative in nationally or in states around the country.
To Fairfax, Virginia. Good morning, Juliana.
Good morning. I get a little distressed when I hear talk about dissenters against the health care plan as being politically motivated or misinformed. I am someone who is not for what's being proposed, and a lot of people I talk to, including my two neurologists I saw this morning, are also not for what's out there, and I do not consider my views as coming from politics or from misinformation. I do a lot of research and reading and watching the TV and reading the news, and you know, even on today's program, I feel like I hear misinformation coming, but it's coming from the side that wants the health care plan.
What kind
Well, the 50 million number of the uninsured. How come we can't have an honest discussion about that number? That number out there includes illegal immigrants and includes people who can't afford health care and choose not to pay for it. And the other information that illegal immigrants just go in and get, you know, stabilized or, you know, Band-Aid care in the ER. I lived in Texas in a very heavily illegal immigrant population area before we moved here last year, and that is not all they're getting. They are getting great care when they deliver their babies, when they're in a car accident and they're not insured and whatever. They're right there in the health clinics getting all the possible care they can. It's not true that they're just getting minimum. They are getting a lot and costing the system a lot of money. And so there's a lot of, I hate hearing that political thing. It's got to stop being said. A lot of us with opinions against this are very well informed, and we see the system as starting off one way, and then because the government is controlling part of it, it could very rapidly change into just a government system. And if the other guy mentioned YouTube, if you go and watch John Stossel's YouTube report on health care, you won't want what Great Britain has, and you certainly won't want what Canada has.
Juliana, I appreciate your call. At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Susan.
Well, I think this conversation underscores why it's difficult to have a short conversation about any of these issues. Just to amplify on the issue of the uninsured, I don't think any of us would say that all the uninsured don't get good care. Of course, many do. We all pay for it. Basically, we pay for it through the tax code because we help to fund certain provisions of Medicare and Medicaid that go to hospitals to cover care of the uninsured. We pay for it in terms of health insurance premium costs that are shifted onto us as people who hold private health insurance plans, et cetera, et cetera. So these are complicated conversations. I think just to go back to your point, it is not the case that anything being contemplated in Congress today would create anything like the British National Health Service. It just simply is not on the table at the moment. Now, many people might want it to be, but it's not. And so I think what is really lacking here is just the ability to have an extended, reasoned national conversation about these issues, because I think when you have them, people really gravitate to thinking that the current discourse is not doing a service to the degree of complexity that we have to confront.
Cece.
Well, and Juliana's absolutely right that there are many people that have some very real legitimate concerns that need to be aired and need to be discussed. But I think that when you hear us say that some of the activity right now may be politically motivated, the emphasis is on some. And there's no getting around that. And there's certainly politically motivated activity on the left as well. To be sure, there's Organizing for America, and unions are out there right now on behalf of the Democrats saying some things that are exaggerations as well. So that always happens on both sides. But the goal here is to really get to sort of the crux of our healthcare system.
We've had at least 4 or 5 emails to this effect. Jerry from Kalamazoo states it briefly. He says, the Canadian woman with the so-called, quote, brain tumor really just had a cyst. The whole story is false in many ways, but truth is not being considered in this argument. anybody know about this?
Well, I don't know about that specific case, but there is just an astounding amount of mythology circulating in the country about other countries' healthcare systems. Now, I spent a lot of time with health ministers in other countries, and I can tell you none of them think they've got a great health system. Everybody has problems. Everybody is facing enormous cost increases that are decreed everywhere as being out of control, even though they're in some instances a fraction of what we're facing here in the U.S. But Canada's a case in point. A piece of mythology is that everybody in Canada hates the system. In fact, if you go to Canada, most people are actually fairly happy with it. It doesn't mean it's going to come here. And as I just want to emphasize, that's not what's being proposed in any of the legislation on the Hill at the moment.
Susan Dentzer, she is editor-in-chief of Health Affairs Journal. She's also on-air analyst on health issues with the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Cece Connolly, she's a reporter for The Washington Post. Noam Levy, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Clearly, this was a morning we could have spent 2 hours on one subject. We'll do it again. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
Thank
Diane.
You. Thanks,
Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.